Welcome to Radio Today broadcasting in Johannesburg on 1485 AM and nationally on DSTV Audio, channel 869.
Changing Destiny is proudly brought to you by WEM Media, right here on Radio Today. Radio Today, radio that delivers.
Welcome to Changing Destiny. My name is Paul Pereira. You should know his name quite well. He's Mark Pilgrim, and he's been a broadcaster for many years on stations such as 5FM and on Highveld. Now he's on a thing in the northern suburbs called Hot FM. And if you don't know him from radio, then you probably do from television, where he's also been a presenter of reality shows. He's also in corporate TV. He's a motivational speaker. And he's an author. He's just published his autobiography, Beyond the Baldness. And we'll be chatting with Mark just after we've listened to Reality by Lost Frequencies.
Decisions as I go to anywhere I flow. Sometimes I believe, at times I'm wishing, no. I can fly high, I can go low. Today I got a million, tomorrow I don't know. Decisions as I go, to anywhere I flow. Sometimes I believe, at times I'm wishing, no. I can fly high, I can go low. Today I got a million, tomorrow I don't know.
Welcome back. You're on Changing Destiny with Paul Pereira, and today we're chatting with Mark Pilgrim, who's just brought out his autobiography called Beyond the Baldness. Mark, welcome aboard.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, welcome finally to radio, because your book tells us that you've always wanted to be on radio, and here you've made it to Radio Today.
I've cracked it. I've cracked it. Thank you.
That's the interesting thing. You start out in England, where you're living in some small villagey sort of place.
Small town called All Hallows, which is the eve of Halloween. What a happy little village it was.
And it was a place that you stayed with. Your mom was from South Africa, though, so
yeah,
it wasn't too long before you were out here.
So my dad was a British sailor, my mom's South African. They met, it sounds very naughty, but they met on the docks, I think probably in Simonstown. And they fell in love, and she went back to the UK, and voila.
And
I came about.
You came about, and dad moves off at some point, and another dad arrives.
So my folks got divorced eventually. My mom met another Englishman, and I would come out with my mom and stepdad to South Africa at the age of 9. What's really interesting, when I still speak to my dad, and he's the softest, kindest man you know. He sings in the choir, and he does all these very honorable things, but underneath his shirt, you can see the little glimmers of the old sailor tattoos. So he's got the anchor, he's got the naked lady, he's got a big eagle on his back.
Mm.
But you wouldn't expect it when he takes his shirt off at
the
beach.
Get the sense in the book that he was a man of that sort, you know, that he was he wasn't some pushover, not by any means. Now, you come out here, and it's not just anywhere in South Africa. You go to the oddest place of all, I would have thought, a place called Creel. Where's that?
Well, thank heavens people have Google now, that they can figure out where Creel is. It's a very small town, very close to Witbank.
Yeah.
So
in the coal mining areas.
Very much so. My stepdad worked on the power stations. He was a boilermaker.
Yeah,
I still have no idea what a boilermaker does, but he was a boilermaker.
Well, you look around that area and you'll see a lot of those power stations were built in sort of the 60s and 70s. I mean, that was a big time of infrastructure investment there. And I suppose guys came out through that, and then you moved off to Sasolburg. And tell us a little bit about going to the high school there, which is not quite the same as perhaps one might have expected in England.
No, it was a mainly Afrikaans school. It was a dual medium school, but there were more Afrikaans people than English. So I did, I think it was accountancy and bits of biology in English and also in Afrikaans. But my main thing growing up as an Englishman going to an Afrikaans school, the Afrikaans ladies were beautiful. They were beautiful, but I couldn't communicate with them.
In any way,
whether it be verbally or with non-verbal dancing, sucky contact, because I still don't know how to sucky-sucky. If I go to
You were a bit of a loser when it came to...
I sucked. I was dancing. I was the guy dancing loose in the middle. But I used to envy these Afrikaans guys that could go up to a girl they've never chatted to before, just go up to them and say, "Will you make me dance?" And straight away, they're holding each other and they're having a whale of a time. I was very envious. And even now, if I do an event and I'll put on a song, if I'm DJing somewhere, and there'll be one or two people that might sucky, I look at them and think, it's so fluid. It looks so good. I still can't do it.
I know. I've always been envious of it myself. We go back then. It's you're 13 years old, and already, and this seems a bit unusual to me, your ambition is to be on radio. Now, that's sort of an age where one's thinking of being a policeman or a fireman or something. And the radio of the time, because, of course, we had limited choices then, is Springbok Radio in South Africa. And I just want to remind us all how much radio has changed in such a short time, as we just hear this little extract from back then.
North to south, east to west, Springbok Radio sounds the best.
Squad cars. General Motors and their dealer organization throughout Southern Africa proudly bring you the drama, the danger, the thrills, and the facts when the long arm of the law travels in squad cars. The story you're about to hear is true. Details are supplied from the official case files by the South African police. Only names and places have been changed to protect innocent people involved.
Do you know I still listen to Squad Cars?
You do?
They've got all the episodes online, and I forget the exact website address, but if you search Squad Cars Springbok Radio, they're all archived online.
They must
going back to the late 60s. It sounds just like that. From the late 60s to about 1980, was it one or so?
Yeah. It sounds ridiculous almost.
It's just great. I think if you had to listen to it now and you don't have the legacy of listening to it in the past, you might go, this sounds like a load of crap. But if you remember listening to Squad Cars and you listen to it again, it just brings back memories like eating Omar's rusks.
Yeah, men from the ministry.
Yes.
Those were the three wise men, stuff
and
like that.
Check your mate and test the team.
You come to Johannesburg. Tell us, you don't quite go straight to radio. That takes a long time. You become a bit of a Hillbrow Jolla for a bit.
No. In fact, I lived in Hillbrow, but I was so non the Jolla. I just never went to any of the nightclubs. I would walk past Bell and Napoli on a Friday night, walk past the long queue, but I just had a loaf of bread under my arm I bought from Fontana. And I was going back to my apartment. So I only started going to clubs when I started DJing at clubs, which I only started doing when I got onto radio eventually.
University, and then this huge thing happens in your life, and it's really, I think, the defining story of Mark Pilgrim in a lot of people's minds. You're a young man, and then you find that you've got an aggressive cancer.
One of the reasons why I wrote the book is because for the last maybe 15 years or so, I've been doing motivational talks to corporates about achieving your dreams, but not just following your dreams, chasing them. Whether it be in the workplace or at home, we all have dreams, whether it's to write a book or fly an aeroplane or swim with a dolphin or climb the echelons of management. Or I joke with people saying maybe your dream is to come out of the closet. Whatever your dream is, what are you doing to achieve that dream? Because I realized at the age of 18, I was not chasing my dream. I had a bursary with an auditing company. I was going to become a chartered accountant.
This is all sensible things.
Very much so. Yeah. You know, I was very good with maths and accountancy. I'm so anti-DJ in terms of my personality. I'm the quietest one in the room. And I was very good with maths and accountancy. And that's what I was doing. But after having cancer, which almost took my life, I realized that what I had to do was do what I really wanted to do. And that was always to be on radio. But it doesn't happen overnight. So even once I decided, that's it, I'm gonna chase my dream, I will be on radio one day, it still took 8 years of auditioning.
But also you didn't do that immediately. I mean, two things strike me about the cancer story. Firstly is you let it carry on before anybody knows. So you try and avoid it. There's a whole bunch of avoidance making it worse.
Well, for all that we don't revere Lance Armstrong these days, one thing that will always stand out and I will always honor the man for is that he made it okay to talk about testicular cancer.
Mm.
Because me as an 18-year-old, and I realized I had a testicle that started swelling, I didn't want to tell anyone. I don't want to tell Mum that I've got a ghoulie that's starting to become enlarged because Mum will want to have a look. What 18-year-old wants to drop his pants and show Mum the bob and tackle?
That's right.
You don't want to do that. So he made it okay for people to talk about it. But that all happened after my experience. I eventually had to go tell my mum that something was wrong because I realized there was a swelling and it wasn't reducing. It was just getting bigger and bigger.
And in fact, your cancer was all over at that time.
Because I left it, it spread to my lungs and my kidneys as well. So I always say to people, there's many a truth in a cliche. Early detection can save your life. You hear it all the time. You don't even absorb it. But there really is truth in that. That if I had gone to my mum earlier, we might have literally nipped it in my bud. And it wouldn't have gone to my lungs and my kidneys.
And then, Mark, we have the story of you going through chemo. It's a terrible thing. We hear that all the time. Those of us who haven't had it, I don't think quite understand quite how nauseating it is. But you do, and then eventually you give it up, and you just decide, in a sense, I think, to mope, to give up altogether. And you're not even sure how long that went on for.
No, you know, it's all 27 years ago now. It's all becoming a little bit of a blur. But for many people, when you say the dreaded C, they go, oh, you're talking about cancer. But to a cancer patient, when you say the dreaded C, you're talking about chemotherapy. Because for many cancer patients, the cancer itself is not making you feel ill, but the chemo makes you feel incredibly ill. So there you are, you're battering your body, you're going for this chemo every 2 or 3 weeks, and it's making you violently ill for a couple of days at a time. And eventually you just don't have that energy. Your threshold lowers and you go, I just can't do this anymore. Now, fortunately, in the many years since I've had chemo, there's been huge improvements. Yet it still is something which is not pleasant and many people become violently ill from chemo.
You come to a point where you've read something by Benjamin Franklin, of all people, in which you decide now you're going to actually go back in and fight for your life, as it were, for life to be what it could be.
Well, this was the pivotal point in my life where I realized I'm focusing on the wrong thing because chemo was just getting too much for me. I didn't want to carry on anymore, so I'm feeling very depressed, and I'm living in my mom's one-bedroom apartment in Hillbrow thinking, well, this is all the time I'm supposed to have on God's green earth. And I read an article in Time magazine about Benjamin Franklin, and he was a very clever lad. You know, he wrote the American Declaration of Independence. He was an amazing inventor.
He did stuff with electricity.
He invented the lightning rod. He invented bifocals. Benjamin Franklin invented the catheter. What was he doing with a plastic tube, or maybe it was, I don't know, made of straw at the time? What was he doing that made him think he could put it up there? I mean, very clever man. It helped out medicine in years to come. But he was also a philanthropist and a great writer, and he said many things. And the thing that struck me when I was reading that article, he said, some people die at 25 and are only buried at 75. Now, I didn't have this Oprah epiphany where I went, aha, I see the light. My focus has been wrong. Mm. But I've always enjoyed a good play on words, and that just kind of resonated with me, and for a while I mulled over it, and then I realized I was just waiting to die instead of really saying to myself, don't just live, really embrace life and chase your dream. And that's when I said to myself, okay, well, I was studying to become a chartered accountant. I always wanted to be on radio. If I'm going to push through this chemo, I'm going to do it because I will one day be on radio.
If I had one worry at that part of your story as I read it, you don't actually say this, but it seemed to me to imply that if you don't want to be cured, you won't be cured, which has another implication of if you're not cured, it's because you didn't want it. Is there not a danger of that misunderstanding?
You know, there's many people that ask about how you overcome the disease, and there's many different philosophies about it. Some will say it's what you eat. Maybe some go on a seaweed diet. Others go to church. Others believe in themselves. I've got a firm belief that you do need medicine. I didn't do any weird or funny eating regimes, but I do believe in a sense of self-motivation. And they had a phrase on the wall of Joburg Gen, Ward 495, and it said, in believing you'll be cured is in itself a step towards recovery. And you've got to have that positive attitude. There was that book that everyone was talking about, was it 6 years ago, The Secret. Mm. It was a book and a DVD where you would say if you're writing an exam, you mustn't keep saying, I must not fail, because that word fail will stick in your head. You've got to say, I will pass. So in my mind, I was saying, I will survive. I literally visualized taking my hands, putting them inside my body and ripping that cancer out. I don't know whether chemically it did anything, but what it did do was give me the motivation to go back week after week and finish the chemo.
And get the job done.
You got to.
Now, there's something that you make your own luck in life, and we're going to talk about that. I specifically want to go through some of the broadcasting time, because you have walked through some big changes that have happened in South African broadcasting, and we'll be doing that just after we listen to Daft Punk's Get Lucky.
We're up all night to get lucky.
Welcome back. You're with Mark Pilgrim, Paul Pereira on Changing Destiny. Mark, you finally do it. You get to radio, and not just any radio, but 5FM, which is the big national radio station for young South Africa.
These days, when someone's trying to get onto radio, there's so many more opportunities. You've got commercial radio, you've got community radio, you've got retail radio, you've got simply streaming online radio.
The university radios are big.
Absolutely. Back in my day, you had campus radio, which only broadcast to the canteen. Mm. These days, campus radio is on a frequency, so you can tune into to Wits Radio or Tux FM. You couldn't do that back in my day. Even Pick and Pay in Norwood turned me down as an in-store announcer, which I love talking about. So funny. And I'm grateful they did. Otherwise, I'd be just here telling you about specials on Butterfish now instead of talking about my radio career. But I did. There was an opportunity. They were looking for someone to do Weekend Graveyard on 5FM, and I auditioned. And I got the gig. It's about being in the right place at the right time.
Well, so much in the right place that you get a call at 2 in the morning, as people do on radio. Mm. And the same caller again, tell us the story.
Oh, you're talking about my first love.
Yes. I think it's a great story.
I met someone via the radio. She would call in, quite often off air. The great thing about doing late night radio, and I always say, if you're new and you want to be on radio, you've got to do graveyard. You've got to get in the trenches and pay your dues. But it also gets you to learn how to connect with listeners. And those listeners would need you as much as you need them, because they're staying awake, they're doing night shifts, or they're students. And this girl was a student at Rhodes, phoned in a couple of times. We connected, and she came to Joburg. And, you know, we landed up being together for about 5 or 6 years.
When I look through the book, the names that come up, and we're talking Alex J., Darren Scott, Carl Kikilis, Gareth Cliff, and your big friend, Mr. Abrams, Randall Abrams. Mm. These are names that come up. They're across the stations. It seems like quite a small industry.
It's a chessboard, and we all just move around.
And there's a lot of moving around, isn't there?
Yeah. You can't burn bridges, because you could land up working together a few years later.
How does that allow stations to build proper personalities of their own?
The problem is, and it was Stan Katz who said this last week when being interviewed on Hot, the station I work for now, he said corporate radio has become unlistenable.
What is corporate radio?
Corporate radio is the big commercial stations.
That's so your Prime Medias, your Cafisos.
So I'm typically the Highfelts, the Jacarandas, the KFMs, the 702s. Mm. But I think he's more focusing on the music stations. What happens is, it's not about the purity of radio anymore. It's about appeasing your shareholders, making sure you generate the revenue, and you are just a pawn in order to get that revenue. Whereas, for instance, on Hot, where I am now, it's all the old 5FM boys. We're doing it for the love of radio. It's about the purity of radio, and that's what I love.
Now, some of the shakeups, I mean, it's not easy. You would be, if we look at 5FM and at Highveld, you were in places for a long time, and then you had to go. Mm. But it's inevitable, isn't it? Because the listenership sits at a certain age group. There's a bracket for it, and we grow through it.
Well, that's right. And sometimes their target market changes. So Highveld in the last maybe 2 or 3 years, maybe 3 or 4 years, their target market has gone typically from the, if I had to say, 25 to 49, it's now gone to maybe 18 to 25. So they've changed their target market. But yes, as a DJ, you do get older. And not that age makes a difference, I think, so much, but it is the psychographic, it's the lifestyle. Can you relate? So I did the chart show for 10 years, and I stopped 2 years ago. I was still in the groove. I was still enjoying all the music and having fun and doing all the concerts. But there does come a point. I realized I wanted to leave Highveld when the jocks were having a program meeting, and they were talking about their favorite restaurant, and one of the guys said McDonald's, and I don't think he was joking. And, you know, I'm a little bit older now. McDonald's is not my... If I had to choose one restaurant, it probably wouldn't be McDonald's.
I wouldn't call it a restaurant per se. You go on to reality TV, I mean, right at its beginning in South Africa when Big Brother was massive. It wouldn't be now, but since then we've had things like Idols and we've the various SA's Got Talent. And even now Clover has a little cookout program. Mm. Have we killed the formula? Is it done now? the reality and you knocked out and you the tribe has spoken.
I think as long as people come up with ingenious twists, there'll always be a market for it, but I don't think it'll ever be as big as it was. Big Brother was the original one. In fact, you think about it, there were 12 people doing bugger all in a house. Now it's 12 people that have to do things like The Amazing Race or, you know, live on an island and do weird things and eat bugs. Big Brother was just be in a house, do nothing, and we all watched it. It was an unknown format in South Africa, and it just worked so well.
How did you find moving on to that? Because it's different to radio, surely very.
Absolutely. I had done a TV show before that called New Moves, but it was a pre-recorded, it was like a cheap version of Top Billing.
Right.
But this was the first live show I ever did. It was phenomenal. I remember about 3 weeks into Big Brother saying to myself, just absorb this moment. I'll tell you where I was. I was on the corner of Sandton Drive and William Nicol. We had cameras out there as people were pulling up the robots. About 2-3 weeks into Big Brother, we were asking them to roll down the window and just quickly give us their thoughts on Big Brother, and people were going wild. And I said to myself, never forget this moment. You'll never do a show this big in your life again.
Well, in that sense, that's probably quite true. On radio, your biggest show was the Kia Top 40 on Highveld, and that brought in a lot of money.
Not for me, but for the station it did, yes.
And how often is that the case that one can, because that makes you almost indispensable to a station, I would have thought.
No, to a you see, that's the thing. To a corporate radio station, you're always dispensable. They have this thing about they never want your brand to be bigger than the station, and I believe the two go hand in hand.
Well, you make
you hold each other up.
You make a point when you leave Highveld, the farewell party. There's no management, and in fact, and none of your colleagues. Now, I don't know if that's because you're a difficult bugger. It could be, but I've found that often at places that when a chap leaves after a long time, it's as though he'd never been there.
It saddened me a little bit that when I left Highveld, and I chose to leave Highveld probably just a year or two before I would have got the heave ho anyway, but I chose to leave and. Even though I had the show that generated the most amount of money, the only show, fully sponsored show on the station for a couple of years, bringing in millions, not even just a thank you from the top guys.
A widget in a machine, basically.
Yeah, I'm a fart in a thunderstorm.
What is happening now? Because we've got about a minute left. The book kind of ends. I don't, you know, we talk about, okay, there's the children and there's Mark, Dad Mark. Mm. And then... what's happening? We don't have a sense of where you're headed.
As a freelancer, the definition of a freelancer is you're half unemployed. You never quite know where the next big gig's coming. So we always wait with bated breath, and I always look left and right to see what opportunities there are. I'd love to do another big TV show. I do corporate television, but we don't have time to chat about that now. And I'm on hot, and I do a lot of MC work and voiceover work and motivational speaking. So it's a lot of different avenues I'm in, but all kind of linked together. I'd love to do another big show on TV.
Beyond the Baldness by Mark Pilgrim. It's published by Tracy McDonald Publishers. I don't have a price for it here.
What it's about, as an e-book on Amazon, it's about, correct me if I'm wrong, but about 170 or 180, and as a hard copy and exclusive in a store, it's 270.
And it's pretty much everywhere in the country because those chains are. So easily got. It's just come out. That's Beyond the Baldness by Mark Pilgrim. Mark, thank you for coming aboard.
Great being on the show. Thanks for having me.
And glad to have somebody from another radio station sitting in here. Very, very good of you to be here. And thank you to producer Edward Musashi and to all of you listeners for joining me, Paul Pereira, on Changing Destiny. And please do the same thing same time next week on South Africa's Thinking Station, Radio Today, from Dar es Salaam to Cape Town, DSTV Audio 869. Goodbye.